some of the entertainment portion of this talk, because I'm the only one that's talking about soft matter physics, non-quantum. But, and this is the part, I chose this talk because it's closest. I guess I should put this down. It may be closest to what you're familiar with. I'm going to talk about classical Wigner crystals, charge systems which organize, and trying to frustrate them by crystallizing them on different types of surfaces. That induces topological defects, which we study, and some of them are unusual, especially when we get to curved surfaces. We can study them. The big advantage of soft matter over hard matter is, for one thing, you guys work in K-space, okay? There are things you can see in real space that you can't have a chance, a hope of seeing in K-space, okay? Like, for instance, some of these topological defects. You can also control things with optical tweezers in classical systems, which is something you can't usually do, grabbing electrons and moving them around. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. On a flat surface, for example, up on top, if this thing works, I hope, for instance, you can take a perfect lattice, you can put a set of optical tweezers on it, you can shear it and create pairs of dislocations which can move. You can study what happens on curved surfaces, so this is a capillary bridge between two slides, as you deform the surface simply by pulling the surfaces apart like that. And you can see how the defects come in and out. Finally, what I end up showing you at the end, hopefully at the end of this talk, is fractionalization of a classical particle. And I don't mean cutting it in two. Okay. All of this is the work of a postdoc that I had over the past couple of years, who you guys will hear about a lot in the future, William Irvine, who's a real master. He started out doing quantum optics, and now he's doing soft matter, and he's an assistant professor at Chicago. Okay, so this stuff started out with a study of hard spheres. So you guys know, or you should know, that the densest packing of hard spheres in three dimensions is this FCC lattice over here. It's been known for millennia that that's the densest packing ever since people invented fruit and grocery guys, you know, knew how to stack this in the densest packing. It's only been proven in the past, I think, 11 years mathematically that this is the densest packing. It fills space to 74%. Over here, if you don't take your ball bearings like Bernal did here and stack them up by one, you just pour them into something, they'll fill space to something that's much less dense. It's 64%. It's random. And although you can mathematically prove that this is the densest packing, no mathematician touches this problem because there isn't a good mathematical definition of random if you put in that the particles can't interpenetrate. If they can't interpenetrate, they're correlated. Once you put that correlation in, you no longer have a good way of defining what random is. Okay? On the other hand, this problem is equally as old as that one. If you wanted to sell bushels of material and you didn't have a scale, if you could figure a way to pack less densely than somebody else, you'd get more money for your grain. So it's been known for thousands of years, you know, this is how to do this problem, what the densest packing is, which is 64%, and not so much how to make it less dense than that. It's a problem whose solution is better known than the question. Okay, now, this doesn't sound like physics yet, but van der Waals, okay, in the 1800s, when people knew about ideal gases, he said, if you want to go from an ideal gas to something that's interacting, the first thing you ought to worry about is not attractive interactions, but the fact that your molecules take up space. Okay? And therefore, you should exclude the volume of the particles, n times the volume of the particle, from the volume of the space you're working in. That means your entropy is no longer just n log v, but n log v minus nb. If I factor out the v there, this looks like v times 1 minus phi over phi c, where phi c is the densest packing that you can have. And simply from this fact alone, simply that particles don't interpenetrate, excluded volume, nothing else, no other interaction, aside from that, you end up crystallizing. And the reason simply is, it's clear that at 64%, okay, at 64% for a certain volume fraction, I will have less entropy and higher pressure. The pressure is just the derivative of the entropy with respect to volume. It diverges, therefore, at close packing over here. So it diverges at 74% if you're crystal, 64% if you're random. That means the entropy somewhere over here is always higher if you're in the crystalline phase, because you have more space to move around. And that, in fact, is responsible for most things that crystallize. It's not energetic, it's entropic. The reason most of the elements crystallize and crystallize in this structure is because of entropy, despite what you may have learned otherwise. Okay. Now, in soft matter, people looked at this problem for a long time. They made hard spheres, particles that were supposed to have no interaction other than excluded volume. A typical sample is PMMA. This is plexiglass spheres about 1 micron in diameter. You have to coat them with a slight hair, which is maybe 1% of the diameter here, 10 nanometers thick, to prevent van der Waals attraction from getting them together. You put in a solvent then where this polymer brush on the surface is in a good solvent. It swells. It keeps the particles from getting into a van der Waals attraction region. But aside from that, they're just hard spheres. And people have studied this for a while. Beautiful experiment was done by Peter Pusey and Van Magen in the 80s, where they simply took these samples. They made vials of them. If you could, I don't know, this doesn't show too well in these lights, but over here it's milky. Over here it looks like it's an opal. And over here you've got the opalescence on top and milky on bottom. Over here it's liquid. Where it's crystal, because you're dealing with micron-sized particles, they Bragg scatter visible light instead of X-rays, so they're colorful. That's what makes opals work. Okay, and over here, what they claimed is you had a glass phase. Okay, this is happening near this random close packing of 64%. Okay, so this is a beautiful experiment. It agreed with what was known from computer simulations at the time, which was that you should have a liquid phase up to about 50%, and then you should crystallize above. And the computer simulations also showed that there was this glassy-like phase from 58% to about 63% random close packing. Okay, so this is a great experiment. It cost about $10, $15 to do this experiment. And all of us in soft matter were really envious that in hard condensed matter, people were spending thousands to millions of dollars doing experiments, whereas our experiments were only costing a couple bucks. So what we wanted to do is make this experiment as expensive as possible. How do you make this experiment as expensive as possible? Send it into space. Okay? So you take these samples, right, which show all these beautiful effects on the ground, and you send them into microgravity. Because after all, they're sedimenting. That's one of the reasons you saw layers in those things. Okay, so you send it up into space. Now it costs you $500 million, much more expensive than your experiments, okay? And you actually find something. What you actually find is that the way these guys grow has dendritic instabilities and stuff like that. But the main thing you find from this experiment is this glass phase, which was in all simulations and all experiments that were done on the ground, is gone. There is no glass phase for hard spheres, which otherwise crystallize. If they're all monodispersed, they're all the same size. And it happens in space. They crystallize immediately all the way up to 64%, 63%, 64%. And since this experiment and some simulations which were done at about the same time, all the experiments and all the simulations show that there's no glass phase. Okay, so it's actually worth doing the experiment in microgravity. Okay, this shows you, for example, when things land, when they come out of orbit, the acceleration that they go through is plus or minus 50 g's, 50 times gravity. So almost everything melts when it comes down. But the glass samples, these high volume fraction samples, were so stable that they survived reentry, and we got them back in our lab. And now the question is, somehow did we screw up? Maybe we sent this wrong concentration, stuff like that. You don't want to destroy it, because if you want to crystallize again, you'd have to send it back up, right? That's no good. It costs you another $500 million. So instead, what you do is you take the top half of the sample, you leave it crystalline. You take the bottom half of the sample, you take this little stir rod, you mix it up, you make it a glass, okay? Crystal over here, grown in space, glass melted on Earth. Here's a stir bar. The bottom of the sample is over here. It's a glass, so it's rigid. So this guy is suspended and doesn't fall. This is a year after we did it. The crystal grows into the glass because it's the stable phase above the glass. And it says that there's no glass phase for hard spheres, which was an interesting thing to know. Okay, so then people said, well, maybe we can do this experiment more cheaply. Maybe we don't have to send it into microgravity. Maybe what we can do is we get rid of van der Waals interaction as best we can by matching the dielectric constant or the dielectric function of the solvent with the dielectric constant of the spheres. So the spheres attract the solvent as much as they attract each other. So that uses two components. You have to mix different solvents to get that. If you mix a third component in, you can both density match and index match. So that's what people tried. And what they ended up with was something that looked like this. Here is a nice crystal over here. Here's another sort of not quite so nice crystal, but this one is certainly a nice crystal you're getting over here. The only thing is these are 1 micron particles, and this is 30 microns. So they're nowhere near touching. So somehow, in trying to density match these, they've charged them. And this is a Wigner crystal, okay? And it comes from charging it. And it's got a very long range, right? I mean, it's 30 microns between these guys. It's essentially macroscopic. This is a confocal microscope image that you can see. If you have charged particles in suspension, well, if they're charged, just like everything has to be, you know, globally neutral like a metal, okay? This has to be globally neutral, so the countercharges to the charge on the spheres is in solution. That gives you a screen Coulomb interaction, a Yukawa potential. This is the same thing as you get between electrons in a metal. The only difference is here, the screening depends on the density of charges, okay? The screening length is the density of charges, epsilon kT. If I made this KTF, it would be Thomas Fermi screening in a metal, right? Otherwise, it's the same thing. But it's a Yukawa potential instead. So the question is, how in the world, with this short-range Yukawa potential, could we get these Wigner crystals that were so big? It turns out that stuff was done by the group in Utrecht, who were trying to density match and index match at the same time. They couldn't figure out what was going on. I was at Princeton at the time, and they brought their samples over to Princeton because we had some good instruments. We were studying charged colloids. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. They couldn't figure out why they were so well charged and why the screening length was so long. And actually, sometimes they would see with a large screening length, sometimes they wouldn't. And I remember from when I was doing hard condensed matter physics that when we prepared samples, the biggest pain in the butt was if we were evaporating samples on a slide, it often depended on the humidity because water condensed on your slide. So I said that's usually in a lab the thing that's most irreproducible. So since we can't control humidity that well in our labs, the thing to do is you add some water to your sample and you see what happens. And as soon as we did, we got these enormous Wigner crystals again, and it became obvious why. The reason is oil has a low dielectric constant. Water has a high dielectric constant. If you have anything charged, it would rather be in water than in oil. So the water just sucks the ions out, right? And it completely cleans up the system, and it makes your screening length very, very large. Okay, so this is what the sample looked like. I hope you can see it. Here is the oil with their sample in it, with the particles charged in it. Here's a drop of water, okay? And here's the nice Wigner crystal over here. But all sorts of other stuff is going on. There's this big depletion zone over here, which is enormous, like 100 or 200 microns wide. That must mean that the water is charged, okay, and repelling these particles. Okay? And then there's this other layer here, which we'll get to in a second. Okay, so first, this business of the water sucking ions out of the oil is a physicist's way of looking at things, right? Because to us, all ions are the same. But to a chemist, they're not. And in fact, water will suck positive ions out better than negative ions because they have different hydration shells and stuff like that. So aside from pumping all ions out very effectively, it pumps more positive ions out than negative ions, and it leaves the water positively charged, which is what these guys are, which is why there's that repulsion. What that means is if I got rid of the colloid and I just put the water in, okay, in the oil, the water would be charged. How can we see that? We took this oil and we added a drop of water in it and we sonicated it. The charged water droplets repel one another and they form a Wigner crystal. This is a Wigner crystal of water in oil, nothing else, no surfactant. This is not vinaigrette, okay? Vinaigrette has surfactants in it and stuff like that to stabilize it. This is completely charged, stabilized, and it lasts for like a year, okay? Now, what about this layer that's next to it? That's also kind of funny. So it took me a while to figure this out, but, okay, if I have charges over here and there's a high dielectric, okay, by the way, this is what they look like. If I blow up that region, here's the water, dyed, here's the oil, here are the charged particles next to it. Okay? What happens is, if you put a charged particle next to a conductor, it sees an image charge and it gets attracted. Right? And if it's near a dielectric, it also gets attracted, not by exactly the same image charge. Okay? So what happens here is, even though the water is charged the same as the colloid, and there's a region that's excluded because of Coulomb interaction, if it gets close enough, the image charge will trap it, okay? And these particles are very hydrophobic. They don't like water at all, so they stay outside the water, but they're attracted to it, right? And it gives you a monolayer here. I thought this was a great discovery, right? Nice way, you know, that if you have repulsion at long distances, you can get attraction from image. It's in chapter one of Jackson. Okay. Jackson tells you, if you have a metal sphere, charge it, you can get anything, you know. If you bring the same charge next to it, it will always stick. Okay, I won't go much into this. The imaging I'm going to show you from now on, so this means I can take a layer of water and I can get a monolayer of colloids which are repelling each other on a two-dimensional surface, on that surface, and all the other particles are way far away, okay, or excluded from that region from Coulomb's law. Now we're going to study this by confocal microscopy. So what confocal microscopy does is you illuminate with a light source. It doesn't have to be a laser, but usually is, through a pinhole. You focus it through a lens, so your illuminating light only illuminates this spot. And now you focus your lens so what you're detecting is just light coming from that spot. That allows you to see deep into a three-dimensional object, because your light is focused at the same point that you're detecting. But it means that you don't get a good image. What you have to do is you have to sweep that point, right? Much as you would with an AFM or a scanning squid or anything that you use, okay? So it becomes a scanning measurement, but it allows you to do good three-dimensional imaging. The other technique that's really useful is just the opposite of a charged particle is attracted to a dielectric. If you have a dielectric, it's attracted to where there's a strong electric field. And light, if you focus it down, light's an electric field at high frequency. If you focus it down, if I have a diffraction-limited focus spot over here, then a dielectric particle with some dielectric constant will get sucked in by a force proportional to minus its dielectric constant times the gradient of E squared. So this is the energy, and the gradient gives you the force. There's a photon pressure that pushes you out, but this is essentially the way optical tweezers work. And what William did, my postdoc did, is he got rid of that so you could trap anything by taking a confocal microscope and having optical tweezers coming from the top and the bottom. You can now see everything. You can tweeze anything you want because the photon pressure is equal and opposite in these two directions. And you can image at the same time through the bottom one. So this is what the apparatus looks like. And actually, can we turn the lights down here somewhat? The movies will be better if we can turn the lights down. Is there any way of doing that? Is there any way of turning these lights down? There must be. Is somebody there? That's up, down, other way.
Great.
Better, okay. So for instance, what we're gonna see is, a cover slip with a thin layer of water on it, a 2D crystal, and the excluded crystal above it. So that looks like this. OK. Do you guys see that? So here is a 3D crystal. There are gradients in it, so it's not uniform. And here's sort of what we're going to be studying, this 2D crystal here, where you can see everything nice and lined up, essentially as far as you want. So now we'll just do a little bit with that, okay? And this is going to be a little bit, it's going to look like what I'm showing you is simulations. Nothing that I'm going to show you is simulations. It's all experiments, okay? So what you do is you take an image, okay? You find the center of these guys, you locate them as points, and now you can do all the coordination you want with them. So you can see the hexagonal lattice. You do the orientation. You color, what we usually do is we color the orientation depending on, you know, once you've got the coordination over here, you can look at the angle for this hexagon, get the orientation, and you color it along with this color map. So here, an edge of the hexagon is up, and over here, the edge of the hexagon is the perpendicular direction. Okay, so then this is what it looks like. That's what the orientation looks like. Now, there's a defect here. Everything is six-fold coordinated in two dimensions. Hexagonal lattices are the rule, as you know from flux quanta and everything else. And this is a 2D Wigner crystal over here, except for these guys where you see a 5 and a 7, which is a defect, right? Topological defect. Now, you can see them easily by, for instance, several constructions. Of course, what you know about topological defects, although I'm not sure you use that so much in when you're looking at them in topological insulators and stuff like that, is the main thing that, one of the main things a topological defect does is you don't have to see it to know that it's there, right? You can do a covering surface. And the easiest topological defect is a charge, and you know Gauss's law tells you you don't have to see the charge, you do an integral over a surface, and if there's a net flux out, you know there's a charge inside. All topological defects have that effect. In this case, the topological defect, in this case with the 5 and 7, which is actually a composite of two other topological defects, gives you these two rows of extra atoms, or in this case colloids, that go out like that. Usually, if it was a square lattice, you'd only see one, but for a hex lattice, you see two like that. And if you go around where the topological defect isn't, you do a walk 3, 3, 3, and then repeat it, and you come back to the same point. And you guys probably would know this if you took solid state physics 40 years ago, before Cattell and Ashcroft and Murray deleted anything about dislocations from the textbooks, okay? But if you do a walk around here and there's a dislocation there, you miss by what's called a Burgers vector. Burgers vector, of course, is quantized. It only comes in units of a lattice constant, okay? And that's sort of what it looks like in this case. You don't complete it. There are more crucial, more important topological defects for what I'll be talking about, which are disclinations. So a disclination is what happens. Disclination means you're changing inclination, you're changing angle, okay? Dislocation means you're changing position. This has to do with orientational order. This has to do with translational order, the dislocation. What happens is you cut out, let's see, over here, you take a hex lattice, you cut out a wedge of 60 degrees, you paste the two sides together, you get a disclination. Since it's an angular defect, this thing costs you an enormous amount of energy because the strain field grows with distance, right? If you put, the same thing is true for this guy, which is a negative disclination, where you add 60 degrees, okay? If you put the two of them together, you get a dislocation. And dislocations are much less costly. Here the strain grows as R, the strain grows as, dies as 1 over R for the dislocation. Okay, so dislocations have two motions. If you had a square lattice, this is easier to see. There's a glide direction, which is over here, where it's very easy to move because all you have to do is associate this row of atoms with the next guy. Okay? You do this one by one. So you take this guy, you associate now this row with over there, and you move this over. So glide is easy. Climb actually means you have to take a whole row of atoms out. So you can watch these guys diffuse around. They diffuse around. You can do other things with them. For instance, you can take a system with no dislocations in it. You can shear it by putting optical tweezers on your lattice and pulling it. That's what I showed you to begin with. So you can create them and destroy them at will. Okay. They react in a hexagonal lattice. the Burgers vector, I can add this Burgers vector to that Burgers vector and get that Burgers vector, okay? That's conserving Burgers vector, okay? And so I can get reactions. Here is, with I move over an array, and I can split that one dislocation into two. There are all sorts of cute things you can do with this. Domain boundaries between different orientations involve rows of dislocations. Dislocation gives you a dipole field. That's essentially what this guy shows you. That's one dipole, and you can see the strain field around it is one dislocation. You can see the strain field around it is a dipolar field. Here's an interesting thing. This dislocation over here has two extra rows that go out like that. If I take my laser tweezers and I put it on this lattice and I expand it, this dislocation would like to go like that. Okay? It would like to go in this direction to relieve this strain, okay? Because it's got two extra lines there, and it would like to go where the density is lower. Okay? But it can't because that's a climb direction. So what it can do is when I put that on and I expand it, I wish I could, let's see, can I speed this guy up? Yes, I can speed this guy up. What it does is I expand it, and what it does is, come on, it divides into two, it reacts, and these guys glide, okay? So you can do all sorts of things with this in 2D. 2D is not the most interesting here. Ah, here's something for Patrick. So one thing you can do is you can make a Lee Rice domain. So you can take this and you can put a random potential on it, and you can watch the lattice break up into these different domains over here, which, if this were a flux lattice, would pin it. And you can actually study the dynamics of how these little domains here, okay, which are taking advantage of the local potential due to the optical tweezers here, how they form and how they relax. So you can do all sorts of things with this two-dimensional lattice. Another thing that's really cool is you can create a grain boundary. And this is kind of neat. You take your tweezers in the middle and you rotate. A grain has a different orientation. Okay, a grain boundary is between two crystals with different orientations. You can take this region and rotate it. And where am I in my talk? I'm almost half done, so I better not spend too much time on this. This is kind of neat because it shows you part of the irreversibility of dislocation motion. That is, you start out with this guy. It's better, actually, that's why I want to be here. It's better if I control it. So you start out, if I can do it, you start out with it a perfect lattice in the middle. I grab it. Now I rotate. In order to rotate, I have to make grain boundaries. I have to generate dislocations. I generate dislocations. Now, in order to increase the angle between these, I have to increase the density of dislocations on that grain boundary. So I generate these guys. They all condense around. And at something like 30 degrees, the density is maximum. Now, as I keep on going, okay, they could annihilate one another, or they can change the density by moving out. And what they do is they change the density by moving out. And now when I rotate back, you might expect them to collapse, if I can do that. But in fact, what they do is they, again, change the density of dislocations by spewing them out. Oops, I can't get that to move like that. Right? And so I've done a complete cycle here, and it's irreversible. And you say, yeah, OK, that's, you know, dislocation, plastic deformations are irreversible. But step by step, they're not. I won't go much into that stuff. Okay, so now, you don't have to just do flat surfaces, right? It's any water-oil interface, any vinaigrette interface that you want that you can do. So you can do spheres, you can do domes, you can do cadenoids, you can do barrels. Okay, here is a dome, right? This is the way we view it with the confocal, right? So you can see nicely that you can see all of the particles there and track what they do. Now, you guys know that a hex lattice tiles flat space completely. Okay? You also know that if you try and tile a curved space, You can't do it with hexagons. It's frustrated, okay, by the curvature. And the reason you know that is because you played soccer. And a soccer ball, instead of having just hexagons on it, has 12 pentagons on it, right? And it has to have exactly 12 pentagons. Actually, a net of 12 is what it has to have. And why is this? Well, this comes from Euler. Euler sort of taught us how to count. If you have any closed surface, okay, then the number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces has to be 2. Now, you can verify this with the tetrahedra. Vertices 4, edges 6 over here and 6 on the bottom, 3 over here, 3 on the bottom triangle, and 4 faces. That, by this arithmetic, gives you 2. So does a cube, so does a icosahedron. So does a sphere, right? So if we take a sphere, and we want to do this with a sphere, I have to make sure that when I end up, when I add up vertices, edges, faces, I end up with 2. Let's just try it by looking at each vertex. So I look at a vertex. A vertex, if it's part of a hexagon, that's one vertex over there. It's got 6 edges, but they're shared with other vertices, so I divide by 2. And it's got 6 faces, but they're shared between 3 vertices, so I divide by 3. You add this up, you get 0. So if I have nothing but hexagons there, I violate this. I add it up and I get 0. If I put a pentagon in there, right, I put in 1 for there. I've got 5 neighbors shared with 2. That's minus 5 heads. There are 5 faces shared with 3. This adds up to 1/6. So a pentagon, when I add it, counts 1/6. I have to have 2. That means I need 12 of these. That's why a soccer ball has 12 pentagons exactly, right? Now, so far so good, okay? Now, what if I remove a face? I can do that. I can take a box and I can take off its top. And Euler's sum over here, which gives you the Euler characteristic, holds for anything that's topologically the same. So if I have a closed surface over here, if I just put a boundary on it like that, it's like removing a face. The Euler characteristic is 1. That goes for, well, if I take off both faces, so I get a cylinder over here, I get 0. And this thing means any time I take a sphere and I put a cut in it like that, I do any opening whatsoever, down to where it's a disk, that all has Euler characteristic 1. And that means when I sum up the topological defects, that's what I have to end up with. I sum up the 5s or whatever, that's what I have to end up with. Okay, now the problem is that once I do that, this is what I get in bulk, but I also have to worry about the boundary. Because it turns out if I have a boundary particle or vertex, and it's got 4 neighbors, it contributes nothing. If it's got 3 neighbors, it contributes plus 1/6. And if it has 5, it has minus a 1/6. Just as a 7 would in the bulk. So now what I have to determine is no longer just topology. The sum is topology. But where the topological defects are is energetics. Okay? If I just have a disk over here made from hexagons, you can immediately see I have to end up with 6 times 1/6. So I have to end up with 6 1/3. Here they are. If I have a cylinder, which is the same as having a disk with a hole in it, I have to have 6 here and I have to have minus 6 here to give me 0. Okay. Now, where do they want to be? Do they want to be on the surface or do they want to be on the edge? And that brings up another thing about topology, which is the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, which tells you that these defects are related to the curvature. And the easy way of doing that, instead of just telling you that, is to show you the following. Hexagon made from a completely frustrated spin system. No, made from a hexagonal lattice, okay? So this is nice and flat. There are no defects in it. If I make a disclination, by taking 1/6 out, 60 degrees out, and now I put it together like this. got curvature, right? It's got Gaussian curvature, intrinsic curvature. Intrinsic curvature means that you can tell by being on the surface that it's curved. What does that mean? Well, the easiest way to do it is if you take a circle of radius r, like that, okay? And I take this surface and I bend it any way as I want. If I go around that circle, it's still 2 pi r. If I draw on a sphere, okay, on a sphere over here, if I go down from the pole to the equator and I ask what's the length of the arc down, and I call that the radius, going around the equator, I get less than 2 pi times that distance. As the same is here, right? If I go this way, I would have had to walk around 6 of these guys, okay? Now I only walk around 5. So this has intrinsic curvature to it. It's positive curvature. It's just like a sphere. I'll pass this guy around in case you guys don't believe me. And, of course, if I take something where... Uh-oh, am I running out of paper clips? I'm running out of paper clips. I thought I had more paper clips, but maybe I don't. Where did they go? Anybody have paper clips? There's one going around. That won't help. Okay. So if I do this, if I add 1/6, I get that. And that is a saddle with negative curvature, right? So it turns out topological defects, disclinations, are sources and sinks for curvature in the same way that charges, conventional charges, these are topological charges, in the same way that regular charges are sources of... yay! Thanks, Patrick. Okay, so here, I can pass this around and you guys can see as well that has negative curvature. Okay, so what you'd think then, okay, is that one of these guys, putting in a plus one, a pentagon, is going to give me curvature that's essentially pi over 3. You can integrate that. The other one should give you minus pi over 3, the heptagon. And you can also tell, of course, that these guys are curved because parallel lines diverge or converge on these two surfaces. Okay? And let's see. This will be important for later, but it's kind of cool. If you put them together, actually, what I showed you is they give you a big strain field. Let me go back up. So it looks like, you see, if I put a pentagon in flat space, it really has an enormous strain field. Same with sevenfold defect over here. It strains the field like this or like this. If I make a cone, actually, it doesn't. And if I actually put these together with these magnetic sticks, it turns out if I come out of the plane with this step over here, here's a 7 and here's a 5. These two together should give me a dislocation. You can see the dislocation by going this way. If I go like this and like that, there's an extra row over here. If I go like that and like that, there's an extra row over here once I step up. So it'll give you a structure like that. We won't worry about that too much right now. But the question is now, if I start taking a sphere which is supposed to have a net 12 fives on it, and I start cutting it, looking at fractions, looking at different integrated Gaussian curvature, and I look, well, this guy, as soon as I cut it, its Euler characteristic is 1. There must be 6 fives on it. Or there could be, I need 6 1/6 net, but some of them can be on the rim, and some of them can be on the surface. And your intuition is, because the disclinations are sources and sinks, okay, for curvature, if I do the Gaussian curvature, I expect the number of disclinations on the surface, okay, to increase as I increase the number of steradians on the surface. So we're going to go from a flat surface to a curve to a more curve. So I go from flat to this to this. and I look at the number of disclinations on the surface, compare it to the integrated Gaussian curvature, and there's noise all over here and stuff like that, but it pretty much works. You'll note that there's nothing that tells me that I can't end up with 12, okay, by having 22 sixes and 10, I mean 22 fives and 10 sevens, right? All I need is the net to be 12, right? That's actually something really interesting that Mark Boeck, who we collaborate a lot with now, and David Nelson showed, which is really clever. I have to say, this is really a clever thing. The Earth, right? The Earth is a sphere, right? So here's my hexagonal paper. Where's the defect? Right? I put it down on the Earth. Where's the defect? Well, locally, the Earth is pretty flat. But you know you have to have defects on it. You have to have these fives, right? And a five looks like this. Independent of the size of the Earth, a five looks like this. And this is going to cost me an enormous amount of energy, right? So what do you do about that? Well, suppose it was an electrostatics problem, right? And you put charges down every once in a while, and they cost you a lot of energy. What you do is you screen those charges. Well, you could screen them with other charges, but you can't add more or less charges to it, so you screen it with dipoles, right? And if you screen with dipoles, dipoles are dislocations. So you end up with something where you've got a disclination surrounded by strings of dislocations. And these guys are called scars. And people, Dave Waits, who actually did his undergraduate, not here, but at the University of Waterloo down the block, was one of the first to study them experimentally. These are sort of what they look like when we study them. And you can see these long strings, right, that go like that. And that's what relieves the defects here. That's not our main point. Our main point was just counting to see whether the disclinations on the surface went with the integrated Gaussian curvature. And it does here. Okay. This is nice. This is spheres. The only thing that anybody ever did before was spheres, positive curvature. Negative curvature is much cooler. Negative curvature, yes? Does it what?
That's the implication. Because I was thinking you were going to say about.
Oh, no. No. Because we haven't, because there isn't a reason to tile the planet with hexagons yet. You, of course, if you tile it with anything, you're going to get defects, right? The Gauss-Binet theorem is, you know, and Euler's theorem will tell you all sorts of things like that, like the number of vertices. But if you don't try and tile it, no. If, for instance, you try to comb it, you have the hairy dog problem, and then you're going to get two poles. Anyway. I could do something with weather with that, but I'd rather not. Anyway, negative curvature is much cooler because, for one thing, this is a pseudosphere. This is the best you could do to make something with constant negative curvature, but it's impossible to embed this in a three-dimensional space. Okay? Something with constant negative curvature doesn't embed in three dimensions. You can, however, make capillary bridges which have negative curvature. How do you do this? You take one of the domes we had before. Our dome, mind you, is simply, we've got oil, we've got the colloid in the oil, put a drop of water down, we get a dome. So now what we do is that we get the drop of water, we take the top slide, we push it down until it touches that, it wets it, we let it go back, and we've got a capillary bridge. And it's got negative Gaussian curvature in the middle. And here's sort of what it looks like. And this guy should have sevens in it. Right. First of all, what I should say is the problem with this is it doesn't have constant Gaussian curvature. It's got gradients in the Gaussian curvature. The curvature, the negative curvature, is highest on the waist and lowest over here where it contacts the slide. In fact, this shows you the gradients. This is a color map where the negative curvature is highest here and lowest on the edges. Okay. And you expect to see where there's highest Gaussian curvature, negative, disclinations, which are sevens. And sure enough, there they are, and that's the first time they were seen. So now the question is the rule that we had, you can do lots of them, of course, is the rule that we had that the number of disclinations varies with the Gaussian curvature. Does that work for negative curvature as well? Well, we've got all this data. You just plot it. There's the answer. What? That looks really funny, right? It doesn't look like it at all. There's a big range. We've got lots of negative Gaussian curvature, and there's nothing. There's no disclinations on the surface. They're all essentially on the boundary. They're all associated with the boundary. Okay, no free ones on the surface. So you ask, well, is it because the Euler characteristic is different? You do barrels. Barrels have also an Euler characteristic. See, this is a cylinder topologically, so its Euler characteristic is zero. So the net number of topological defects on it is zero. Net topological charge is zero. The same is true for the barrel, but the barrel actually has defects on the surface. And it just goes with what you're saying. So we looked at it and we said, gee, that looks like a familiar curve. Maybe what we've got is a rectifier of topological charge. It's a diode. So if you guys want to make an instrument, you know, make a transistor that works by topological charge, we know how to do it. Okay? I don't know what good this would be, but in any event, that's one possibility. So one of the cool things about soft matter is you really have control of your system. You actually can see what's happening while it's happening. So you can actually take this guy and you can just stretch it and you can watch what happens. Okay? And what happens is, well, you can't tell that much from that. You can see things coming in. You can see it actually likes to have these things do a belt around it, okay, when it can. You do much better when you do the triangulation. Then you can actually see what's happening. And what you see is as things are going on, what's happening is there are none of these free disclinations in the middle. Instead, there are these lines of dipoles with no x-disclinations, which are coming from the boundary. And these guys are polarized. That is, they're all pointing toward the middle. That is, the green part, which is the 7 over here, and the 5, they're directed toward the waist. So it took a while for us to figure out what this was. And what we finally realized is that these guys, okay, I guess I'll show that to you in a second. I'll show you first the movie going on. What happens is as the movie goes on, as we increase the negative Gaussian curvature in the middle, these guys break away from the boundaries. The boundaries recede, and you get the free disclinations in the middle. What turns out what these guys are the equivalent of pleats. Okay, so when people invented clothing, okay, which was also a long time ago, one of the first things they invented with clothing was a pleat, because your waist has a different circumference than your hips do. And in order to make up for that, you have to add fabric as you go down your leg, right? If you put dislocations together, dislocations add extra rows as you go down, okay? Now, it turns out that these are just like dipoles. And dipoles can't give you the same thing as a charge does, okay? The only thing with dipoles that can give you the same, or with polarization, they can give you the same as charges, is if you have a gradient, right? If you have a gradient in polarization, that's a polarization charge, right? And so if I just had a series of dislocations here, what it would give me is it would give me a dress that flares out, or pants that just flare out in a cone. And a cone, it turns out, has no Gaussian curvature. But if I have, if I end it, or if I space my dislocations with different spacing, then I can get Gaussian curvature. And that's what happens here. You can see here, parallel lines are diverging as I go through this. So here they're together, so there's no Gaussian curvature. When I go through this, which is where this line ends, there's some Gaussian curvature there. And I won't go through much of this. I'll just say that, in fact, that's what happens here. And these guys are essentially pleats. They're the equivalent to pleats in a crystalline surface. So here's what I showed you before, or what we've been passing around for what the strain field is and how you can relieve the strain field when you put it together. If you put dislocations together, something like that, okay, and now you squash this down, you can see that the effect of that pleat on the surface is to give you a splay, that is to make parallel lines diverge. And if I put these dislocations as close together as I can, I get an angle here of 30 degrees. Disclinations give you 60 degrees. So in fact, pleats, which was known to people that did clothing forever, is a very, very fine way of adjusting curvature, okay, by doing this. And that's essentially what this thing shows. Now, one way to prove this in a way that you'll remember is a structure which just has these steps. So this is like the five, seven, five, seven. These are 5-7 pairs, so the dislocations. And what I showed you before is those look, if I don't want to flatten a sheet, they look like steps out of the plane, right? If these guys are equally spaced, then I get something which is essentially a cone. I only get something with curvature if I change the spacing. So one day I'm running around Manhattan, jogging around, I look up, and I see this. Okay? Chrysler Building in New York. Most beautiful skyscraper in the world. Anyway, this guy, you look at it, and it's got these steps on it, right? And now you measure, well, you don't measure. You look up what the spacing is. 8.4, 8.4, 8.4. You look at this, it's a cone. Over here, the spacing increases. Negative curvature, right? So it really shows you that. And my biggest accomplishment of that year was actually getting a picture of the Chrysler Building published in Nature. Anyway, okay. Now, why does this work? How does this work in this case? The answer is you can figure out if you put in a disclination and you try and relieve the stress, the curvature, by the disclination, okay, this is the curvature that you're going to compensate, the integrated curvature you're going to compensate by a disclination which comes in these discrete units of pi over 3. Okay? You can just see, if I say there's a certain radius that this will compensate, that radius has to do with the square root of, in this case, since it's negative curvature, the product of the radii of curvatures in the two perpendicular directions over here. And now you ask yourself, is this region bigger or smaller than the height of my catenoid? If it's smaller than the height of my catenoid, I'm better off doing it locally, so I add a disclination. If it's bigger than the height of my catenoid, then I'm better off just bringing it in from the sides, and those are the pleats. And that's the way it works. Okay, so finally, what happens if you add particles? Everything I've shown you is with a fixed number of particles, okay? But you can take the laser tweezers, and you can take a particle, and you can add it to the system. So here's flat space. Here's a particle that I'm going to add, right? What happens is you put the particle in, and it goes in, and it distorts the lattice, and it makes it interstitial. Now, interstitials are stuff that nobody worries about, right? They do scattering, stuff like that, but they're not topological. They don't destroy translational order. They didn't destroy orientational order. They're neutral defects, okay? They just sit there and diffuse. They sit in interstitial, okay? What they're composed of, if you want to look at it in terms of defects, is since they're neutral, they have neither topological charge nor dipole charge. They're actually like quadrupoles. You can see this guy goes in. Let me just run this again. It goes in, and it creates either two or three dislocations, which add up to zero, right? Which add up to zero, because it can't have any topological charge, it can't have any Burgers vector. This guy will then just move around, okay, diffuse around, and not do anything interesting in flat space. If you have an interstitial and a vacancy, they can annihilate one another, but aside from that, it doesn't do very much. Okay, now what happens on a curved surface? Okay. Now remember, in a flat surface, the difference is, in a flat surface, I can have no strain whatsoever. I don't have to have any defects around. I can have it strain-free. Actually, it's kind of funny because it turns out interstitials are not supposed to be affected very much by strain fields either. That is, interstitials won't give you, if you put a gradient on a system in stress, they won't relieve shear strain on a crystal, right? So they're not defects that destroy any of the order or any of the rigidities in a three-dimensional crystal as well. Okay, so here I'm going to add with the tweezer a particle. You see there's a nice regular lattice. Of course, it's got defects on it, on the crystal. Here's the triangulation of it. And what happens, it goes in, it forms three dislocations, and those dislocations get absorbed by a scar. Well, that's pretty cool. Not so unusual and stuff. Okay, let's try it again. Here again, we add it. You see there's a nice ordered region over here. We add it. The order is disrupted, and then something happens, and now it's completely ordered again, right? Let's follow that over here. Okay, so here's the particle goes in. It makes two dislocations. One goes that way, one goes that way. It's undistorted. The mass over here is the same as it was before. Half the particle went up, half the particle went down, right? And this is essentially equivalent, for example, to what you do with polyacetylene, right, where you add an electron, and half the electron goes into a phase slip, if you want, over here, and half goes into a phase slip over there. And this is just the classical analog of that, right? And it's just really cool because you might have thought this is a completely quantum effect, but in fact isn't. It's a completely density wave effect is what it is, right? It's simply that you should see that you go in here, and before I put that particle down, I have a nice ordered hexagonal lattice right where it goes in. Okay, the net effect of it, if I let it go, is it goes in. You'll see it come apart again. Half up, half down, and the region in between is left as its perfect hexagonal pattern again. You can do this, this is Mark Boeck stuff. This is actually Mark Boeck's suggestion. Although he didn't think of the fractionalization, I guess. But here he's looking at the energy of it, a particle added, and the strain field goes to the two scars that were on the surface. There are more movies, but it'd take more time to show. But this also works for negative curvature as well. And you can see it's not just the singular time that we see it. Actually, the neat thing is, I should say, that what we haven't seen yet, and we still want to see, just for the sake of it, is if, let me go to this one. Oops. If we put this in exactly the right space over here, it would actually go to 3, right? It would actually go to 3 dislocations, because the interstitial is 3 dislocations, and they'd fractionate into 1/3 particles. Okay. So my time's over. Actually, I timed it pretty well. Actually, it's also true, by the way, that these guys are charged. So to the extent that I coarse grain, I've also fractionalized the charge of these guys, right? Because in fact, this is the Wigner crystal that we're dealing with. Okay, so remember this guy. You're going to hear from him. What he's doing right now is he's blowing vortex knots in fluids, okay? What he did as a graduate student is he made electromagnetic knots with light. Okay, then he did this stuff, which is topology. Now he's doing hydrodynamics, and he's blowing trifoil knots of vortices in a fluid. He's a great guy, and you'll hear from him. And essentially, mostly what I wanted to show you is that there's lots of stuff you can do in soft matter where you really have a handle on it, and you can see exactly what you're doing. And you can discover some things that you knew and some things that you didn't know. And thanks.